Retreat is a rather strange thing that we do. And especially in this tradition, because here we are, a group of people coming together, sitting in silence, not even making much eye contact, trying to be very quiet, very internal, dealing with our own struggles together. What I find very moving about this is how much we help each other without saying a single thing. Throughout the retreat, the quieter we become, I think the more we become aware of that. And a natural feeling of gentleness, a natural arising perhaps of compassion for our own problems or issues that we're dealing with, and for others, just seems to come up. And as we quieten even a little bit more, we begin to sense that this is also true of the world around us, that there is a kind of love that is in the trees, in the rocks, that they are not other. They too are part of us. And as we heard yesterday from Kate and from the various readings of Dogen and Gary Snyder, that's the main teaching that they want to give us. Today, I'm going to continue on talking a little bit more about the mountains and river, or mountains and water sutra. I just wanted to say, just before I pick up another little passage from there, it's unusual that this is called a sutra, because it's not written by the Buddha or spoken by the Buddha. And it's the only, as far as I know, the only piece of writing that Dogen did that has this attached to it. And it's because, not that Dogen is talking or teaching about the Dharma, it's that the world speaks the Dharma. This is the teachings of the natural world around us. And therefore, I think he attached, at least I think Dogen, attached the word sutra at the end, just as if the Buddha was speaking, because in a way, it is the Buddha speaking. So let me read. I'll be reading little passages of the sutra and then making comments on it. And I'll try to make sure I'm clear about when it's Dogen speaking in the sutra and when it's just me. So Dogen. From the timeless beginning to the present, the mountains have always been the dwelling place of great sages. Wise ones and sages have made mountains their personal chambers, their own body and mind. And it is through these wise ones and sages that the mountains are actualized. Although many great sages and wise ones have gathered in the mountains ever since they entered the mountains, not one has been encountered. No one has seen one of them even once. There is only the manifestation of the life of the mountain itself. Not a single trace of anyone having entered can be found. Mountains have been the dwelling place of great sages. When I was thinking about this, I was remembering the Desert Fathers. In the Christian tradition, there was a group of men, and I'm not sure if they included women as well, but we have the writings of the men, who became known as the Desert Fathers. They were the first kind of hermits or recluses in the Christian tradition. They retreated to the desert for periods of fasting and pilgrimage and spiritual retreat. But in East Asia, of course, the sacred quality of mountains has always been acknowledged. Long, I think, even before Buddhism came to China or Japan or Korea. Because in other traditions that we find in East Asia, for centuries, men and women have gone to the mountains for solitude and for religious practices. And this is actually true today as well. Particularly in China and Korea, women and men retreat to the sacred mountains. And there they live in small huts, often for months or years, cultivating their practices. And lo and behold, here we are in the mountains, cultivating practices that have been passed down to us from our ancestors. And yet, Dogen writes at the very end there, in case you missed it, not a single trace of anyone having entered can be found. Why is this? For Dogen, to enter the mountains is to become one with the mountains. Our Zazen practice, our Kinhin, our walking meditation, chanting, bowing, eating odyoki together in silence, the long quiet times that we spend together, are just to meet the mountains, to become intimate. To become intimate. We become intimate with ourselves, we become intimate with each other, and we become intimate with this place. Looked at from a distance, from far away, mountains can seem kind of small or they can seem large compared to one another, but in entering the mountains, large and small don't quite ring true. Large and small don't quite ring true. How could we possibly find anyone when we are intimate with mountains? How could we find the wise woman who is at one with the river? Dogen continued on a little bit. The appearance of the mountains is completely different when we are in the world, gazing at the distant mountains, and when we are in the mountains, meeting the mountains. Isn't that true? You know, when we look far away, and then when we're right in the mountains, there's something very different. When I wait for a beloved friend in a coffee shop or a restaurant, I see people often all around, large and small, male and female, tall and short, young and older, each one different, each one separate. Each one not me. And then when my friend arrives, intimacy arises. Before even one word is spoken. And if we haven't had a chance to meet for a long time, still there's no sense of strangeness. Our experience of the mountains is completely different when we observe them from a distance than when we are in their midst. I love mountains. I love mountains deeply, and I have ever since I was a child. Growing up in Calgary, the Rockies were only a couple of hours away, and trips to the mountains always filled me with a kind of light joy. Dogen writes, "We are in mountains meeting mountains." When we meet mountains, when we become intimate with the mountains, or rocks, or trees, or water, our everyday understanding of who we are drops away. and the earth, waters, and sky become fully alive. Well, yesterday Kate talked mostly about the mountain, so I'm talking mostly about the water. What is water? When I was preparing for this talk, I came across a reference that another Zen teacher, a man named Daido Lori, had made, and I looked it up, and it's a poem by D.H. Lawrence, the English novelist and poet and writer. And he wrote this about water. Water is H2O. Remember your high school chemistry? Water is H2O. Hydrogen, 2 parts, oxygen, 1. But there's also a third thing that makes it water. And nobody knows what that is. The atom locks up 2 energies, but a third thing is present, which makes it an atom. Dogen, kind of interestingly, writes about this in almost a similar way. He writes, water is neither strong nor weak, neither wet nor dry, neither moving nor still, neither cold nor hot, neither being nor non-being, neither delusion nor enlightenment. Frozen, it is harder than a diamond. Who could break it? Melted, it is softer than milk. Who could break it? There is a kind of a mystery about water that D.H. Lawrence refers to and that Dogen is really calling upon us to recognize fully. Because, you know, we could also say, kind of paralleling what Dogen has said here, water is strong and weak. It is wet and dry. It is moving and still, cold and hot, being and non-being, etc., etc. But Dogen is telling us here that water is not these dualities. It is something that is perhaps elusive and beyond these virtues or qualities that we give water. Something more, as D.H. Lawrence says. It's a third thing. And so are you. Dogen uses the metaphor of water, but this is true of everything, and it's true of you and me. We are beyond our views of ourselves. We are beyond our virtues or our characteristics, whatever we think they are, or whatever other people tell us they are. Yes, we can be crabby, we can be smart, tall, thin, in pain, full of doubt, stuck in anguish. We can be at peace, we can be joyful, we can embody all kinds of dualities, and at the same time, we are more. Recognizing this can be a blessed freedom. A freedom from the strident voices inside our heads about how our life should be different or how we want to stay exactly like this and never change. Frozen, Dogen writes, it is harder than diamond. Who could break it? You know, reading this brought to mind the great icebreaker ships that struggle to keep a passage open. You know, made of these huge honking ships made of, you know, heavy metals, you know, trying to keep passages open or a port open in cold winter. But the other image that came to mind was ice jacking. Are you familiar with that expression, ice jacking? It's when a large kind of sheets of ice actually flow off a lake. And they can destroy homes that are right beside the lake. I've seen pictures of these big pieces of ice just kind of crushed right into homes. Rather unusual, but it happens in the States particularly. And then Dogen writes, melted, it is softer than milk. Who could break it? So water, hard and soft, flowing and still, we can recognize these qualities in water. Can we recognize these qualities in stone, in mountain, and in ourselves? And Dogen continues, this being the case, we cannot doubt the many virtues realized by water. We should study the occasion when the water of the Ten Directions is seen in the Ten Directions. This is not a study only of the time when humans or gods see water. There is a study of water seeing water. Water practicing and verifying water. Hence, there is a study of water telling of water. Isn't Dogen like one of these long poems? You're going, what? 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 Water is seen everywhere in the Ten Directions, right? Kind of a Buddhist or Chinese expression, I'm not quite sure which came first, but you know, everywhere, right? We see it. Ten Directions everywhere. And I was reading recently, scientists have even discovered small traces of water from samples brought back from the moon in the Apollo 15 mission that took place maybe before some of you were born, from 1970, right? That's a long time ago. Even on the moon. Water fills the Ten Directions. When we bring our awareness to that, our study of water goes beyond how we usually see water. Dogen says, water sees water. Water sees water. Water practices and verifies water. Water tells of water. What does that mean? In the Genjo Koan, another piece that Dogen wrote, there's a very famous passage, which I think indicates what he's trying to tell us here. He wrote, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the Buddha way, to practice the Buddhism, is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. Water practices and verifies water. Water tells of water. It does this when you, when I, am being rather than doing. When subject and object become intimate. It kind of like this. The insentient water recognizes the insentient water inside. Recognizes the insentient water outside. The insentient water outside recognizes the insentient water inside. We believe the world is out there. Always out there. Dogen is telling us, no, the world is never out there. The world, there's no inside or outside. There's no inside or outside. We'll come back to that in just a moment here. To To study the self is to forget the self. We meditate, we drop off our chattering mind, quietens down a little bit. And Dogen continues writing in the sutra, we must bring to realization the road on which the self encounters the self. We must move back and forth along and spring off from the vital path on which the other studies and fully comprehends the other. So in Zazen, our Kinhin, work practice, doing services, in our mindful activities, we place ourselves in the position. We take the position, or we place ourselves on the road on which the self encounters the self. To encounter the self, to encounter who we are fully, the kind of busy cognitive chattering and functions are quieted, and we fully enter this present moment. We're not thinking of the past, future, fantasy. We fully enter this present moment. Senses open. Chattering mind, maybe in the distant background, maybe quiet. And then, whatever we have considered the other miraculously transforms and is no longer the other. That sense of other drops away. And the narrow path of our everyday life disappears. Dogen writes, in general, the way of seeing mountains and waters differs according to the type of being that sees them. In seeing water, there are beings who see it as a jeweled necklace. This does not mean, however, that they see a jeweled necklace as water. How then do we see what they consider water? Their jeweled necklace is what we see as water. Some see water as miraculous flowers. Although it does not follow, they use flowers as water. Hungry ghosts see water as raging flames or as pus and blood. Dragons and fish see it as a place or a tower. Palace or tower. Or as the seven treasures of the Mani gem, kind of a special jewel in Buddhism. Others see it as woods and walls, or as the Dharma nature of immaculate liberation. Or as the true human body, or as the physical form and mental nature. Humans see these as water, and these different ways of seeing are conditions under which water is killed or given life. So we are conditioned to see things by, first of all, our physical sight organs, our common education, and our language. All of these kind of narrow our perceptions. But we are kind of in the habit of assuming that what we see is reality, or that it's the whole of reality, right? Doing it right before your eyes is on an advertisement I see, kind of changing your oil or something. But consider how a bee sees. Humans see only a rather minuscule fraction of the electromagnetic spectrum. We call it visible light, right? And it's really a relatively small sliver going from red to violet, if I remember correctly. I think that's right. And this is the way we perceive the world using our eyes. However, bees and other insects have a different view of the world. Their whole range of sensing light has shifted towards the violet end of the spectrum, and they don't perceive red at all as we see red. They simply see colors, though, that we cannot see. Ultraviolet. Bees see a world that we are completely blind to. And Dogen uses a classical Buddhist teaching called the Four Views of Water to remind us that our views of even things as common and as ubiquitous as water are only partial. For a fish, water is like air. For a dragon, it is a palace. For a hungry ghost, it is a substance of pain and disgust. And of course, for a chemist, a scientist, it's a molecule containing one oxygen and two hydrogen atoms that are connected by a covalent bond. Everyone know what a hungry ghost is? Hungry ghost is a kind of unfortunate being in the kind of scope of all the beings in the Buddhist universe. Very thin neck, very big belly, unable because of the small mouth and very thin neck to get enough nourishment to fill the belly. And so they're constantly hungry. And they see water. Also, they're constantly thirsty, but to them, water appears as fire and pus. Our view of the world is only a partial view. And isn't that true for ourselves as well? Something we need to learn over and over again, whatever labels we have attached to ourselves, it's only partial, and of course only temporary. Depending on how we view it, water is killed or given life, Dogen writes. Killed or given life. Depending on how we view ourselves, we kill ourselves or we give ourselves life. We kill ourselves or we give ourselves life. What does it mean to give life? What does it mean to give yourself life? How do you give yourself life? To borrow a phrase from Dogen, please consider this completely and fully. How do we give ourselves life? How do you do it? Dogen continues, given that what different types of beings see is different, we should have some doubts. Is it that there are various ways of seeing one object, or is it that we have mistaken various images for one object? At the peak of our concentrated effort on this, we should concentrate still more. Therefore, our practice and verification, our pursuit of the way, must also not merely be one of two kinds, and the ultimate realm must have 1,000 types and 10,000 kinds. Can we use this understanding of what different types of beings see is different? Can we use that to investigate our own views and understandings? What the eye of an octopus sees and what my eye sees, is it the same? The world, the ultimate realm, as Dogen writes, is infinite in its variety. No two snowflakes are the same, as we all learned in elementary school. You ever cut out those snowflakes, you know, you fold the papers. And that no two were ever the same, right? Each snowflake has its own integrity. And at the same moment, the snowflake is just a part of a flow of transformation as water manifests water. And that's true for you. Yes, you have your own integrity. And yes, you are part of a great flow of transformation. One more passage of Dogen. The Buddha has said, all things are ultimately liberated. They have no abode. We should realize that. Although they are liberated, without any bonds, all things are abiding in their own particular state. However, when humans look at water, they have one way that sees it only as flowing without rest. This flow takes many forms, of which the human view is but one. Water flows over the earth, it flows across the sky, it flows up, it flows down. Water flows around bends and into deep abysses. It mounts up to form clouds, it descends to form pools. We too do not have an abode. Like the water cycle, we flow. Our life, like a river, is never constant or fixed in one place. We too reflect that great paradox that Dogen keeps hinting at in these writings. Our uniqueness and our boundless unity exist simultaneously. We are both free and we occupy our own particular state at this moment. We are both free and we occupy this body, this particular state at this moment. Ice, snow, sleet, hail, rain, steam, dew, all different. Yet, all the same. When Dongshan, one of our founders, ancestors of this particular school of Zen, was leaving his teacher is named Yunyan, to visit teachers around China, as was the custom then, he asked his teacher, Yunyan, he said, later, when asked to describe your teaching, how should I respond? When I'm going around and, you know, meeting all these great teachers around China, and they say, okay, well, what did Yunyan teach you? How do I respond? And after a pause, Yunyan replied, just this is it. Just this is it. Now you may wonder, what? I think Dongshan too was, what? Because he departed without comment. Probably a little confused. And it seems he didn't completely understand his own teacher's response. But later on his journey, this was all done on foot, of course. This was way back in probably 800s. Later on, when wading across a stream, Dongshan looked down and he saw his reflection in a still pool of the stream. And as it's written, awakened to the meaning of the previous exchange, he suddenly understood his teacher's teaching. And then he wrote the following verse. Just don't seek it from others, or you'll be far estranged from it. In other words, don't look for the answer from other people, right? And then he wrote, "Now I go on alone. Everywhere I meet it. It now is me. I now am not it. Everywhere I meet it. It now is me. I now am not it. This is the strange interrelationship that Dogen teaches us using water. Everywhere we meet water. Our own body is more than half water. Everywhere we meet it. It now is me. I now am not it. Both our uniqueness and the boundless unity at the same time. Quietly sitting, walking in the forest, you meet it everywhere. Right. Hoping that the bowl with the chopped fruit will get to you before it's completely empty. I now am not it. Yes. So yesterday we considered mountains walking. Today let's turn to the Dharmic gate of water, the slow and fast dance that knits us all together, giving us life. So I think I'll stop here.